case, which is case number 59328, the Power Company, Inc., et al., the appellants versus Kirk and Amy Hamry respondents. Mr. Carfalo, you represent the Power Company. You may proceed with your opening argument. And do you wish to reserve some time for rebuttal? Hmm?
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the Court, Dan Carvalho on behalf of the appellants, and I would like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Sure.
Your Honor, if I may proceed, there's essentially two issues before the Court. It's the application of Rule 41E in the context of a stipulated settlement agreement, and the second prong is the mechanism by which a trial court should properly resolve disputed issues about the enforcement of a contract, whether it's a summary proceeding or something more. Now, our court has a long history dating back to the 40s of strict adherence to 41E dismissals. Our precedent says they are mandatory, that there is no discretion vested in the trial court, and that only a written stipulation can extend the time within which to proceed beyond 5 years, that words or conduct will not impliedly waive the rule. Our court's gone further in more recent decisions and indicated that this is a jurisdictional rule. It is a jurisdictional rule, and thus we don't examine the equities such as, well, if we don't enforce under a settlement agreement, then a party may be required to bring a separate suit. And our court has long held that we don't examine equities as a jurisdictional rule, and that action taken after a motion to dismiss pursuant to 41E is void. In this case, the trial court, in its order, indicated that, in reliance upon Shiro and another case, that California's rule is virtually identical, is the words of the order. In fact, California's rule is not only virtually identical, but California's statutory scheme creates a statutory exception that provides broad discretion to trial court judges. It tells trial court judges, for any reason that you as the trial court may find, that the case could not have been to trial because it was impracticable, because it was futile, or the extreme example, because it was impossible, you as the trial court are vested with jurisdiction to decide that 41E can be excused. That is a dramatic difference from our statutory scheme. We have no such statutory exceptions. In addition to the statutory exceptions, California also has a statute that allows either party, plaintiff or defendant, at any time, to move to reduce a contractual settlement agreement to judgment in summary fashion. We have no such statutory basis to do that. The Shiro court, interestingly, and if you look at the trial court's order, the trial court cites Shiro for the proposition that there was an implied waiver of the five-year rule in this case because the parties entered into a settlement agreement. In Shiro, Your Honors, what's important to understand is the settlement agreement in Shiro specifically vested and retained jurisdiction with the trial court to enforce the terms. In other words, part of the settlement agreement in Shiro was that the trial court will retain jurisdiction over enforcement of this settlement agreement. Now, there was no such explicit written stipulation in the settlement in this particular case. In Shiro, the court found that the statutory exception to Rule 41E applied. The court found that the statutory exception, that it would be impracticable to bring it to trial, invoked excuse of this rule. And, Your Honor, our court has actually dealt with applying California law to Rule 41E in a few instances. And we cited the Thran case, where arguably there was an appeal that would have made it impracticable to bring the case to trial. And our Nevada Supreme Court says that we decline to be bound by the California exceptions. And we are not going to recognize it, even though we might recognize that there's an argument that it would have been impracticable to bring the case to trial. The Nevada Supreme Court has also been faced with the issue of whether a settlement should excuse 41E.
Are you saying that if we accept the respondent's argument that we're overruling all our case law in 41E by then accepting the California rules, where we would give discretions to our district court judges on the five-year rule?
I think that we would have to create a new exception for this case that does not exist in current Nevada law. In other words, we have created historically an exception for cases that are in the medical legal screening panel. We have created an exception for cases where there is a stay. In this case, we would have to create an exception for a settlement agreement. And interestingly, this court has granted motions to dismiss under 41E where it is a harsh, harsh outcome for the plaintiff, one in which the plaintiff has no remedy once it is granted. In this case, that is not the that is not an issue. In settlement agreements, there is always a remedy following the dismissal under Rule 41E, and in fact, that remedy ensures due process when there is a true and bona fide dispute about performance under the contract and whether there is any defenses to the contract, because under a summary procedure, there would be no method by which a party could conduct discovery and call witnesses and set forth defenses.
Why isn't a fact that there's a written settlement agreement impliedly waive the 41E rule? Why doesn't it waive it, especially with everything that was going on in the federal court with this?
Sure. Your Honor, it's because our case law has stood for the proposition that unless it is explicit and in writing, and our statute says that any stipulation to extend has to be beyond, we will not imply it by words or conduct. And so if the question is, well, why shouldn't we impliedly waive it? It has to do with the original rule. Why do we have the rule in the first place, and why do we not have these statutory exceptions to the rule that vests the trial court with discretion to do what Your Honor is saying?
Are we put in a strange position because of the unique facts of this case where the parties, where one side attempted to reduce the settlement to judgment and it was opposed and denied on two earlier dates?
And your question is, I apologize, Your Honor.
Based upon the change in positions, in essence, it's like, well, we have the settlement agreement, shouldn't go forward at this time, we're opposing you reducing this to a judgment at this time.
Sure.
It was brought twice, it was opposed twice.
Sure. And, Your Honor, when those motions were brought, they were brought at a time where it was absolutely clear that the conditions to the obligation to pay were not met, meaning that this viable going concern club had not sold, and there was no way that you could at that time claim to make a voluntary contractual agreement become an involuntary judgment with all of the burdens of a judgment, including debtor examinations, execution on assets, and so forth. And there came a point in time when it was clear that this agreement was completely frustrated by an event that the respondents testified in front of the city council was something that we never imagined in our wildest dreams would ever occur. That event being revocation of the liquor license within 1 month of this global settlement. And that is the basis of the contractual defenses in this case that the trial court not
that's,
only...
That's a very unique fact that you bring in when the licensing agency wasn't part of that global settlement. I've read the settlement. I understand the settlement. But again, and that brings me to that word I just used, global settlement. We don't have a specific stay of proceedings issued by the federal court or purporting to, but this is in lieu of that and the party standing down in light of this. Should the court take consideration of that or not take consideration of that in light of, as you said, the absolute language of 41A?
The whole issue for the trial court is reasonable foreseeability of this event. If the trial court finds that this event was one that was reasonably foreseeable and that we should have made efforts to account for it, then we lose. If the trial court determines, like Mr. Counsel for the respondent told the city council, that never in our wildest dreams was it foreseeable that the city council would take this action, then we may prevail on that issue. But the whole point is that the trial court never gave us the opportunity, nor did it consider the contractual defenses in making its determination. In fact, the respondent's brief and the respondent's brief indicates that the trial court was absolved of the responsibility to consider that issue because the contract provided that upon the contemplated sale of this going concern, this number one club in Las Vegas, that upon the sale of that club, if there was a deficiency, then the defendant was still required to pay. And the trial court believed, and we think in error, that that ended the inquiry of the intention of the parties and the contemplation.
Counsel, could you comment on the holding in Smith versus Garside?
Yes. Interestingly, Smith versus Garside, the plaintiff had asked to be excused from the burdens of 41E because the case had settled and a trial date was vacated as a result of that. And what the Nevada Supreme Court is that if you settle, you are to consummate it and obtain a dismissal. That's what happens in most settlements. You get a full release, not an executory one that says, if you pay in the future, I'll release you, which is what happened here. And two, you obtain a dismissal. You get a stipulation in order for dismissal, typically with prejudice, in exchange. And that did not happen here either. And so the respondent was still facing 41E dismissal under those circumstances. And our Supreme Court would not recognize a settlement as tolling or excusing the imposition of 41E.
How did the district court distinguish the holding in Smith?
Your Honor, I don't know that the district court addressed the issue of settlement and its tolling at the trial court level.
Would it, if this court were to adopt an exception that deals with a written settlement, would it be necessary for us to overrule Smith?
I believe that if you create an exception, you would be abrogating the rule in Smith that settlement does not form a basis to either toll or excuse 41E.
And I guess the policy attached to such a determination is that we would have cases that would remain open potentially for years in situations where the settlement hasn't been completed.
For example, a confidentiality provision. All settlements that have a confidentiality provision that would extend in perpetuity would remain open with the jurisdiction of the trial court to enforce if one side claimed that there was a violation. And with that, Your Honor, I notice I only have about a little under 3 minutes for rebuttal, and I've gone over. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Campbell.
May it please this honorable court, Donald Jude Campbell, Campbell and Williams, appearing on behalf of Mr. Henry. Your Honor, there is nothing, or Your Honors, there is nothing in the present case that requires this court to do anything with respect to the adoption of a new standard or with respect to the adoption of an exception. And the reason for that is very clear and plain in the law. We are not seeking and never have sought to try this case at any point in time following the settlement, ever. This is precisely the same case, precisely the same argument that was advanced and completely rejected by the appellate court in California in Gorman versus Holt. If the court would permit me to just read a very brief excerpt. The purpose of the rule is to prevent avoidable delay in bringing an action to trial. That's what it's designed to do, prevent it from bringing an action to trial, and thus obtaining a resolution of the dispute. An action settled by agreement of the parties will not, of course, proceed to trial. Thus, quote, settlement renders the five-year limit irrelevant. Quote, nothing requires that a case reach judgment within 5 years. It merely requires that a trial commence within the statutory period. And I believe Justice Hardesty mentioned something along that same lines. There's a myriad of situations when you settle cases, but irrespective of that settlement, no judgment is entered. And the case And the responsibilities of the parties to deal with the settlement of that case goes on.
Mr. Campbell.
Something happens every single day with financial workouts, with banks and their debtor clients. What do? You owe us all this money. We're going to give you 8-9 years to pay it off. You have to pay it off. If you don't pay it off, then you're going to be in default of the agreement. We're going to come in and we're going to get a judgment against you. But we're not going to issue a judgment against you at this point so long as you comply with the workout terms, because we understand you don't want it against your credit. We don't want any deleterious impact upon your business or your corporation or the stock, whatever it may be. Happens every single day, every part of the country.
Is this court's statement in Smith at odds with the argument you've made concerning the Garmin holding? Arguendo, if a settlement was reached, counsel was obliged to finally consummate it and obtain a dismissal on that ground before the five-year period ran.
I don't believe so, and this is why, Your Honor, because there was no effectuation of the settlement agreement at all in that particular circumstance. If you recall, in our circumstance, there was actually already a $1 million payment that was made. This was also reduced to writing as well. So the mere fact of the matter is that unlike the somewhat equivocal factual setting that was in that case, this was very clear and concise and demonstrable on the terms of the document itself.
So your view is that once settlements occurred under Resnick, the trial court has jurisdiction in perpetuity to enter a judgment?
Well, I think that is true at any point in time if the settlement agreement has been breached and you go to enter a judgment upon it. Just as the court in Gorman versus Holt said, and all the subsequent cases, there were five of them decided by the appellate courts in California that endorsed that. It's Brown versus V. Bryant, Shiro, Canal, and of course, Justice Pickering noticed in the Kostarthen case that when we're dealing with Rule 41E, this court has specifically endorsed the fact that we should go back and look at California's rule in that matter. And here's an important point, if I might make it. In the Gorman case, there was no reliance in Gorman by the court upon any exception that was set out in the rule. They basically said it's sophistry to come in and say that the five-year rule compelling you to go to trial in 5 years is somehow breached when there's a settlement agreement. The fact that there is a settlement agreement obviates the fact that there's going to be a trial. And it's nonsense to consider that somehow a trial is still involved when that's not what's involved. What's involved is the matter has, in fact, been resolved. And the underlying reason why that rule is there, the vindication of rights and the settlement of the case itself, the resolution of that part of the case, is vindicated by the settlement. To do otherwise gives violence to the idea that parties should be encouraged to engage in settlements and work out arrangements.
What about Mr. Campbell?
Go ahead.
No. Just sure, go ahead.
I was just going to ask about the partial payment. It sounds like it's almost an implied waiver of the five-year rule of the partial payment, especially $1 million partial payment. On this case.
I don't think that you have to get to the issue, though, Justice Cherry, of a waiver. The fact of the matter is that the settlement agreement was reduced to writing, it was agreed by the parties, and performance was initiated and engaged in. $1 million was, in fact, paid. You know, that's a pretty substantial, as the court has noted and you have noted, Justice Cherry, a pretty substantial compliance with the terms and provisions of this.
And, Mr. Campbell, was the district court fully advised that there was a written settlement agreement entered into the parties prior to the expiration of the 5 years?
Yes, Your Honor. There's no question about that because we actually went back in. And what we tried to do is we tried to get a judgment on the basis that Mr. Rizzolo was not performing, that Mr. Rizzolo had, in fact, which is what led the city to revoke the license, Mr. Rizzolo had, in fact, engaged in obstructive activities. Mr. Rizzolo, we knew, was hiding his money overseas. Mr. Rizzolo was engaging in a wide variety of circumstances. So we wanted to get our judgment, and we wanted to try to execute against the judgment Judge Glass did not allow us to do it. That compelled us to go to federal court yet again, file an action for fraudulent transfers, which ultimately led to a money laundering investigation we conducted, and we found millions and millions of dollars that Mr. Rizzolo had put under his ex-wife's name in the South Pacific Cook Islands to keep him out of the jurisdiction of court. We also found that he had sold an interest in a strip club in Philadelphia. And as a result of all that, Mr. Rizzolo went back to jail when Judge Pro found out about it.
Mr. Campbell, coming back to 41E, which requires the parties have stipulated in writing, which they tend to do, but they have to include, if they want to extend time, a provision in the writing as to extending the time. We have that particular caveat in our 41E. California, in their 583 section, under 340, talks about the computation of time, and then they have bringing the action to trial for any other reasons. They have this language, which we don't have. So why should we, under our 41E, do this, or in the alternative, why should we, in fact, look to, even though you initially said we don't have to, adopt, say, the California distinction?
And that's what I had said earlier, Your Honor, and I obviously did not make myself clear or advance my argument correct or in terms that could be understood. Under both statutes, it requires that you bring the case to trial. The issue is you've got to get this case to trial, and if you don't get it to trial in 5 years, you're out. Where there is a settlement, there is no trial. The trial is obviated. It's done. We never sought to impose a trial upon Mr. Rizzolo after we got the $1 million, after we signed all the agreements, after we informed the courts of the settlement. We have never done that. Trial is no longer at issue. That statute, therefore, is no longer at issue. That's the exact point that the court in Holt said what was at issue there. You're saying that the five-year rule is at issue. In Gorman, they said, no, it isn't at issue. What is at issue here is you somehow think that just because you come in with a judgment now, you're trying to get a judgment, that sort of revitalizes this entire process and 5 years applies to judgment? No. The five-year rule doesn't say applies to judgment. It says it applies to trial. This is nonsense. This is sophistry. The court in Gorman essentially said, this is a canard. You're wasting our time with this argument.
So your point is exactly all of this would be fleshed out in an action to enforce a settlement agreement that you never contemplated going to trial once the settlement agreement was entered into, and is the fact that you might have conditional aspects to that agreement, does that affect your argument at all?
No, and the reason why is because you wouldn't have a trial no matter what. What you would have is you would have a judgment, and you would enforce the judgment. And you would say, I get to enforce this judgment. That's what you have, but you never have a trial. The five-year rule does not come into play in this case at all, at any time. It is a complete canard. It is a complete canard. We never sought trial of this case ever. What we sought to do was hold Mr. Rizzolo's feet to the fire when he was hiding all of his assets and get a judgment against him. That's what we sought to do. We sought to vindicate our rights and not let this slippery character get away from us. On a $10 million case that we had against where we have a client who's a quadriplegic. That's what we sought to do. We sought to prevent him from frustrating our rights in this entire matter. I'm open to any more questions.
Any questions from the court? Okay, thank you, Mr. Campbell.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Carvalho, you have about, it looks like just about 3 minutes left.
Mm-hmm. You indicated that the Gorman case did not rely upon an exception, a statutory exception. That's because that was a 1985 case that was interpreting the rule before the statutory exceptions were enacted. At the time Gorman was decided, and when you read the Gorman opinion and the cases that follow it, there was a split of authority before the legislature stepped in and created these statutory exceptions about whether a settlement took you out of the purview of 41E. There's a case entitled Varwig that is within that opinion that indicates that a settlement will not take you out of the purview of 41E. So the legislature in California stepped in and answered that question completely. Now, you know, the circumstances that led to Mr. Rizzolo not performing were the taking of the liquor license. Mr. Campbell is a sophisticated, bright attorney who I am sure did his due diligence and believed, just as we believed, that this club was going to be sold for a lot more money than was necessary to satisfy the obligations to the Henrys. Mr. Rizzolo's only concern at that point was how much he was going to net after the sale of a going concern. And what's lost on this is this agreement, it allowed Mr. Rizzolo, this racketeer. Isn't it ironic that the federal government said this racketeer can operate this club for an entire year with all the same employees, keep all the money for that entire year, and during that time, he can organize an orderly sale of the business so that he can get the best price.
Counsel, you know, the facts of this case are interesting, clearly. But I would ask a simple, what I think is a simple question. What is it about your interpretation that would keep the following from happening? And that is, parties, in any case, enter into what they believe to be meaningful settlement discussions, reach a settlement. And within the terms of the settlement, there are some things that are future actions to be performed in the future. Okay, but let's just assume that we enter into the settlement agreement with no intention to ever pay or honor the terms and conditions of that settlement. And so we just sit back and wait until the 5 years has lapsed, and then we're done, it's over, we're out. On any factual situation like that, I have concerns. And that's what I hear you asking this court to adopt.
Your Honor, that situation would be remedied by summary judgment. In other words, if the five-year rule had run and you didn't have summary enforcement, there is a remedy for that plaintiff. If one party has no contractual defense to performance, like you said, that they were just trying to pull one over on someone, then in a separate contract action, you're not even going to have a trial. A judge is going to rule on summary judgment that the party that did not perform is required to perform, and pursuant to the contract, not only do they have to pay the judgment, but perhaps attorney's fees, costs, and all kinds of other penalties that would be associated with what Your Honor is talking about, which is the point that I was trying to make earlier, is that this court has dismissed under 41E when there was no remedy for the plaintiff, none. Their case is over. In this case, there is a remedy. Dismissing under 41E provides the defendant with the due process to raise his contractual defenses that he thinks he has. It does not get him out of this. It does not obviate an obligation to pay unless the trial court finds that his contractual defenses are valid.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Carvalho. Thank you for both sides for your excellent arguments and briefs, and the case will stand submitted. Also, for the record, I think I didn't mention at the beginning, the Honorable Christina Pickering, Chief Justice, is recused from participating in this case.